I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. There are more than double the number of Republicans than Democrats in the Missouri House of Representatives. Those conditions make it more than tough for the party in the minority. Today, some questions for Crystal Quaid. She's the leader of the House Democrats. One of the first two millennials to lead a caucus in Missouri, we'll ask her how her party can be effective, her views on the governor's first session, and what the decline in tax revenues means for the state. Then, a little-known job with big consequences, portraying patients or family members in teaching hospitals. Find out how paid actors help give medical students real-world experience right here in Kansas City. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. It's not easy being a Democrat in the Missouri House of Representatives, where Republicans outnumber Democrats by better than 2-1. This year, the job has fallen to a second-term legislator, and that's rare in the annals of leadership. Crystal Quaid of Springfield is one of the first two millennials to lead a Republican or Democratic caucus in Missouri. One of her focal points has been what she calls the outsized surprise tax bills that many taxpayers will be facing this year. Another is standing up to a GOP platform that this year includes a major piece of anti-abortion legislation. Representative Crystal Quaid joins us this morning from Springfield. And Representative, it's nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
How in the world did a second-term lawmaker like yourself wind up as a leader of House Democrats this year? Because what you've achieved is pretty rare.
Well, thank you. Democrats in the state of Missouri have obviously not been doing so well over the past several years. And with the loss of Senator Claire McCaskill, and then, we only flipped a few seats in the Missouri House this last cycle, we're really in a stage of rebuilding, rebranding who we are as the party, making sure that folks understand what we're fighting for. The November elections, there were a lot of progressive issues on the ballot that either won or lost in the case of right to work, but yet the Republican legislators were sent back again. So, one of the reasons I wanted to run for leadership was to help in that time of rebuilding and rebranding. It's a really important moment for Democrats in Missouri.
I mean, has it just become a solidly red state, Crystal, in your view? How do you see it?
I don't believe so. And the reason being the November elections, when we're looking at the ballot initiatives, voters overwhelmingly said no to right to work, which right to work has been a Republican agenda item for decades. They voted in favor of a minimum wage increase in transparency in government. So folks in Missouri really support our issues. But as I said before, a lot of it's about making sure that folks understand that the Democrats have been the ones fighting for those issues for so long.
You're outnumbered 114-47 based on the last numbers I saw. How difficult a challenge is it, Crystal, to mount an effective opposition to Republicans when you're in such a deep, dark hole when it comes to the sheer numbers of lawmakers in each party?
It's definitely difficult. But we do several things to work on that. One of the most important for us is when it comes to our issues and getting them across the finish line, not caring who gets credit. My first year that I was in Jefferson City, I gave legislation that I had wanted to get done to a Republican and had that filed my very first year by someone else. And that's something that we do often. We build relationships with our colleagues on the other side around issues that we can work on together. Criminal justice reform is a great example where the Republican majority is finally pushing that as an issue that our folks have been working on for so very long. So it's finding places where we can partner. But then obviously there are a lot of issues that we can't. And so our job is to, stand and be as loud as we can on those issues. And, obviously the numbers are not going to be in our favor. So it's making sure that not only are we trying our hardest in Jefferson City, but we're also making sure that the constituents across the state know what's happening, educating them on what bills are being passed up there, and the reasons why we don't support them or do support them.
Why would Republicans who have such a big majority even be interested in working with Democrats there? Why would they even acknowledge that you guys exist?
Because we have good ideas.
At least that's the idea,
no,
right?
Yeah. No, okay. To be honest, yeah, there are a lot of issues, obviously, that are controversial that we don't agree on. But there are a lot of issues we do. In any given day, there are, 10 to 15 bills that we all vote unanimously, minus a few Republicans who vote no. And so really, it's again, about building those relationships and finding the issues that we can work on together. And it happens more often than not.
Given numbers like we're seeing, how do you keep spirits up in your caucus?
It's not always easy, but we do it in a lot of ways. Celebrating the small wins that we have, while we may not pass bills, get them to the governor's desk, we get amendments on, we clean up language, we, fund things in the budget. We get a lot of things done throughout the budget process. And of course, so we celebrate those wins, but then also it's, goes beyond the walls of the Capitol, and it's working with people in our districts, spreading the message of what Democrats are working on and preparing for the next elections. There are a lot of ways that we continue to stay motivated.
Crystal Quaid, the House Minority Leader in Jefferson City, is my guest. This is Republican Governor Mike Parson's first full legislative session as governor. How's he doing in your view?
As often everyone compares him to our previous governor, and when you're looking at that, most folks say that he's doing pretty well. But, there have been things this session where obviously I would wish that he would be doing better. And you mentioned the tax snafu that's going on right now. And that's one where we have our scene where the governor's administration is at odds with the legislature on both sides of the aisle. So that happened relatively quickly, in my opinion, where it's kind of us versus him when it comes to this specific issue. But that said, the governor does sit down with the Democrats. He meets with us. He meets with our members to find ways that we can work together. So I've got to give him that.
I was going to say, does he sit down with Democrats, and do you have his ear from time to time? Are you able to communicate with him when you feel a need to?
Yeah, I would say definitely more so than the previous governor, which is the only one that I've served under. Mm-hmm. He is willing to meet with us. His staff meet with us often on various issues. He's as most recently, he's created this task force for disability rights, and I'm not sure the exact title, and he has reached out to one of my Democratic members to get her insight because it's an issue that she's been working on. So, yes, he does sit down with us. Obviously, we disagree on a lot of things, but as a governor, he does respond to us.
Well, and that's saying something, isn't it? That's an important thing you're saying there.
Yeah, definitely. And like I said before, in comparison to Governor Greitens, he does respond to our phone calls.
We'll talk about the tax situation in just a minute, but you also get a sense, Crystal, that his honeymoon is definitely over. Is that fair to say?
I would definitely say that.
Because?
Well, we've got this tax issue that we'll discuss. Also looking at the budget. So the budget process right now, when we go back to Jefferson City after our spring break, we're going to be debating it on the House floor. Many of the things that the governor was wanting to do, like the bond for roads and bridges infrastructure, the House simply said no to. There are a lot of ideas that he's bringing to us that the members on both sides of the aisle just are not accepting. And then we have this tax issue where he is actually referred to the legislators of grandstanding when we're just trying to help folks.
Right. Well, he's pushing this two-pronged agenda aimed at infrastructure. We've mentioned that here, and workforce development. Neither has advanced very far. I mean, why not? I mean, you get a sense that the governor picked these two issues because they weren't wildly partisan issues. Mm-hmm. Why can't a Republican governor get more out of a very Republican General Assembly on issues that at least on the surface aren't wildly controversial?
Yeah, well, I definitely can't speak for what the majority party thought process is, but I can tell you from our side, these are issues that we support. Of course, workforce development, infrastructure funding are things that we desperately need in the state of Missouri. But we also don't have the money. If you look, general revenue right now is down 5% this morning. There have been tax cuts after tax cuts every year, and we have no money in the state of Missouri right now. So I know for my caucus, when we're looking at additional cuts to seniors, healthcare, to people with disabilities, not fully funding school transportation for K-12 schools, and we've got 30 some odd public schools who are now down to 4 days a week because they can't afford to keep their doors open, it's really hard to then get behind a new workforce development program that's going to cost us $25 million or $50 million when we're not currently funding the things that we've promised to fund.
With the state broke, that's a pretty serious situation. I've been monitoring the tax revenues too, and you're right, 5% down right now from a year ago. Or is it from a year ago? Or is it from what was expected this year?
A year to date.
Yeah. I mean, that's a fairly ominous kind of situation, isn't it?
Yeah, $400 million.
Mm-hmm. On infrastructure, he'd like to borrow hundreds of millions of dollars to fix Missouri's bridges. What do you and your fellow Democrats think about that plan?
You know, the thought of borrowing the money is not something that I can get behind. As I said, when we look at our budget in general as a state, we really view it as a moral document. Of course, we need to be investing in infrastructure, but if we're not investing in our people, it's really hard to then think about essentially getting a credit card to then do what we should have been doing for many, many years. The Republicans in the budget in the House actually just took $100 million of general revenue to fund it instead of taking out this loan. We are also not in support of that. For one, that's not nearly enough money for the estimates that mm-hmm. we need to invest in our infrastructure. But then also, again, just taking this $100 million is almost like a check to the Senate of just saying, here, fine, you know, put this money wherever you want to. So I don't expect that to make it through the process either.
But the state has a real problem when it comes to funding its infrastructure. Voters just turned down a gas tax increase. They've turned down sales tax increases in recent mm-hmm. years. I mean, this is becoming a problem with seemingly no answer.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. You know, what I honestly, myself and my colleagues look at the tax cuts that we've seen year after year after year in this state, going back to Senate Bill 509, before I was in the legislature, hundreds of millions of dollars of revenue that is now gone. And unfortunately, we can't get back as a legislature. We can't increase that because of the Hancock rule that we have. So, yeah, we are in a situation now because of previous choices made by the legislature where we simply don't have the money. And it's a tough spot to be in, for sure.
You get a sense that even Republicans quietly are saying, you know, we went a little too far on tax cuts?
Oh, for sure. Yes, I know that they are. I've had that conversation with many people.
What's the road ahead when it comes to rectifying that situation, or is there a road ahead?
You know, I don't, honestly, as a Democrat in the super minority, I'm not sure that there's a road ahead. There are still a lot of my colleagues on the other side who think we need to do more. You know, we're looking at the online sales tax through the Supreme Court Wayfair decision where we can now collect this revenue. And you'll see bills in the Senate that have a corresponding tax cut for money that we bring in. So there are folks in the legislature who aren't done yet, which is pretty daunting when you're looking at our budget numbers.
I was going to say, going back to roads, you know, if borrowing money doesn't work, if raising the gas tax doesn't work, you know, where should the state go to find the money it needs to fix mm-hmm. up its roads and bridges and highways? Where do we go?
Well, you know, it's a very good question. Some folks are talking about bringing the gas tax back to the voters with a clean version. You know, the what was presented to the voters in November
was a little confusing because there was highway patrol language in there, right?
Yeah, and I don't even like to say the word confusing. It was silly, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
We had Olympics. There was Olympic tax in there. Highway patrol, you know, there was a whole lot of stuff. And when you read it, it made sense. But I know as a voter, I would say, why would I be voting for this and this and this? That those together just is silly. There's no other word for it, in my opinion. And as a legislator, I can tell you the reason that happened was this Olympic tax was getting through. I think it was the second to last week of session. And there were amendments getting thrown on, and it was simply an act of desperation to try to get something across the finish line. We as legislators,
if you threw in the highway patrol, that the thinking was that people would be more inclined to support that than a higher
right.
tax to improve roads.
Yeah, and they use the Olympic tax bill as as the structure to get it through. So that was a bill that was already moving.
And the Olympic tax bill was some measure to help support Olympic athletes of some kind?
Yeah, so if you
Yeah.
want, if you got an award, you didn't have to pay taxes on it, which
Okay.
in this history of Missouri, we haven't had anyone. But so here, this bill, and there were amendments getting thrown on, and it goes back to our failure as legislators to really do our due diligence, present a clean, a clean option to the voters, and really take the time to do that. So that's one conversation that is happening right now is, do we send something back to the voters that is honest? And that they can actually, tell us whether or not they wanted it. I know several folks who would support a gas tax increase, but didn't support all of the other stuff on there, and the fact that we just threw them this language that was just nonsense.
Could
So that's one
Democrats,
option.
Crystal, could Democrats back that idea of going back to voters with a gas tax increase?
We as a caucus haven't taken a position, but I, for one, always defer to voters and, going back to them with a clean option. And then if they tell us no, then we know that they say no to that. I don't necessarily think that that is the best option for us. I would prefer us to just not have cut, given all these tax cuts, and wouldn't be in the situation to begin with. But again, we are in the super minority and we didn't really have much control over that.
Do you think the General Assembly, is it likely that lawmakers could pass another proposal to go back to voters with a gas tax increase?
I really don't know, to be honest with you. We've seen a few different versions of this going through the House, and there's even one that doesn't actually send it back to the voters. It's just a smaller amount. I'm not sure what the speaker's priority is on that.
Yeah. Okay, if you're just joining us, listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and I'm visiting with Crystal Quaid, a state representative from Springfield, who is the House Minority Leader, the leader of the Democratic Party in the Missouri House of Representatives. We've talked about the decline in tax revenue in the state. Is all that decline, you mentioned it's down 5% this year compared to last, is that all because the tax cuts that passed, or is there some other reason going on out there?
Well, we're trying to figure out exactly the reasons, to be honest with you. And that's been part of what folks may have seen in the news lately of what's going on with the Department of Revenue, and the governor's administration, trying to figure out exactly why we are down as much as we are. And so, yes, I do believe that the previous tax cuts that we've seen in the state are a contributing factor of this. Also, the Trump tax cuts that we've seen at the federal level are a contributing factor to this. And part of it is folks now, we are being told, and again, we're still trying to figure this part of it out, but we have these surprise tax bills that folks are now receiving in the state of Missouri. So there is assumption that folks are not paying their tax bills as timely as they have in years past.
I was going to say, you use this phrase, surprise tax bills. What are you talking about?
This year we are seeing in the state of Missouri, and there are several states across the country that are in this situation, where folks who may have previously received tax back at the end of the year are now owing to the state of Missouri and owing to the federal government as well. So with the Trump tax changes that happened at the end of last year, deductions have changed. There was a whole lot of change within that legislation. Missouri is coupled to the federal government on our tax structure. And so now, because of that, folks have to go in and change their W-4s of what they withhold versus previous years. And if you want to say receive money back at the end of the year, folks were not notified to change that information. And so now we're seeing across the whole state that folks who may have received a couple hundred dollars back are now owing in. And that's not everybody. And of course, the numbers are there's a wide range, but we've seen folks who, I can tell you, a woman who works in the building in the Capitol, who is a single parent, and she received about $3,000 less from the federal return, and then owed into the state about $300 more than she did in previous years.
Wow.
So it's almost a $3,500 swing for her.
You propose taking a couple of steps to deal with this. What would you like to do?
Well, one thing that I want to do is, because the state of Missouri did such a poor job of notifying folks of this change, since the beginning of W-4s, Americans have never had to adjust the way that they function. We have developed behaviors of whether or not you wanted to pay money in or have a, you know, this big check at the end of the tax year. Folks have grown accustomed to the way that our tax structure has been. Since it changed, we didn't notify anybody that this was happening. And, you know, Missourians are not tax experts, overwhelmingly so. I'm not a tax expert. I'm a social worker. And so we didn't tell anybody what was going on. So now folks have these what we're calling surprise tax bills because they were. Nobody knew that they were coming. So one thing that we've proposed is simply if folks enter into the payment plan, getting rid of any penalties or fees that they may have. Mm-hmm. And so it's not that we're trying to have folks not pay the taxes that they owe. Most definitely they need to pay them. But if they have to enter into a payment plan because they didn't know this was happening and didn't have time to prepare, we don't want to penalize them for that either.
And maybe give them longer to pay the tax bill, you're saying, mm-hmm. Crystal?
Yeah, that's an option as well. So there have been a few different bills that I've filed two different bills, and then the Republicans filed one of my bills as well. And one was to give an extension, like an extra month to pay, and then allow folks to enter into the payment plan. The second bill, which is the one that seems to be moving on the House side, is simply just gets rid of the interest and penalties.
Hmm. Yeah, I can't help but notice that we're less than a month now before the tax filing deadline. I gather you would think that Republicans need to get moving on this issue when you guys get back to work next week.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, the first bill that I filed, I pre-filed. I filed that in December, December 20th, I believe, because we realized this was an issue at the end of last year. The governor's administration realized it was an issue in September. And then our folks, we all started digging in to try to figure out exactly what happened. And it was House Appropriations staff, our budget people who are nonpartisan, who work for the House, who really figured out what was going on and that there were these huge discrepancies. And so we knew about this at the end of last year. I filed a bill to try to get the conversation started, hoping that it would move the process along faster. But yeah, you're right. We're a month out and we haven't even gotten a bill out of the House yet. So it's worrisome that there's not going to be any support.
What's your theory as to why that is? Why aren't Republicans a little more concerned about this and moving more quickly?
You know, I can't really answer that question. I think that once session started and the revenue numbers continued to get worse, I think folks started to get a little bit more alarmed. And then the speaker did create a special committee on government oversight to look into this, to mm-hmm. ask the Department of Revenue what was happening. And I understand that process takes some time, but yes, they could make it a priority. They could have had this bill be the first bill out of the House. And we have had a committee hearing on the Republican version of the bill that hasn't had a vote yet. So that would be a good question for them.
You know, Crystal, I want to go back to the notion that revenue flowing into the state of Missouri is off by as much as it is 5% or so. If those numbers persist, I'm wondering, first off, do you expect them to persist, or is the thinking in the Capitol that eventually things will level out as this tax situation gets ironed out?
Well, the conversation in the beginning, honestly, it was that it would level out, that folks would, there would be enough of these tax bills that Missourians received that once they paid them or the state had to pay out less money in returns, that it would level out. That was the conversation. And the Department of Revenue kept saying to us, you know, mid-February, towards the end of February, we'll have a better understanding. We'll see the numbers. It'll start to level out. Well, in fact, it's not leveling out at all. And so I think that's where, as of, you know, the past week or two, folks are really starting to worry.
So if those numbers persist, you know, what does that mean for programs like K through 12 education, higher education, mm-hmm. other state programs, the ability to set aside $100 million to improve roads and bridges? What happens then?
Well, you know, if the numbers don't get any better, the governor is going to have to do some withholds where he gets to, you know, essentially he'll go in to the remaining of the fiscal year budget and decide what not to fund for the next couple months. And then when it comes to our new budget, you know, that's it depends on what we pass through the legislature, obviously, but then the governor would have to do withholds again. Right now, the budget that's moving through the process is betting on the fact that we will level out. We have what's called a consensus revenue estimate that we budget off of, and that's a number that a bunch of folks decide on at the beginning of the year. And as of right now, that number is still has us at 1.7 growth.
But no question about it, it sounds like lawmakers are pretty concerned about this. There's a wild card hanging over the session, if you will.
Definitely, definitely
Yeah.
concerned.
You know, another big development this session was the passage in the House of a major anti-abortion bill. Among other things, it would ban abortion if a heartbeat or brain activity is detected around 8 weeks of pregnancy. If this proposal was to become law, Crystal, what would the impact be on the number of abortions in the state?
Well, I will say that, you know, before this bill's passage, Missouri is pretty restrictive when it comes to abortion access. We have one facility in the whole state that folks can receive the service at, and that's both the pill or the surgical procedure. And there's a 72-hour waiting period. We have a very restrictive abortion policy in the state of Missouri already. This bill obviously restricts it more. This may be the most restrictive in the country if it was to pass. You know, most women don't even know they're pregnant by 6 or 8 weeks. But then there's also no exception for rape or incest in this bill either, which is very concerning when it comes to trauma and the effects that that will have on mental health of women. In terms of lowering abortions, I don't know that it will. Folks will continue to have abortions. We've seen that since the beginning of our country, that women will obtain abortions. The question is whether or not they're safe for that mother to have the procedure.
You know, there's been speculation that Republicans have pushed this bill in an attempt to take the issue before the U.S. Supreme Court and, again, you know, test the Roe versus Wade standard. In your mind, was that the main intent of this legislation?
Maybe. I mean, I can't say yes or no on that. There are other states that have passed similar legislation already that have kind of beat the Republicans to the punch, so to speak, in terms of being the first state to get to challenge this. There are already states who are doing that. Maybe the Republicans want to add Missouri to any potential lawsuit that happens. I can't really tell you, to be honest, what the intent is there, other than taking away the option for women to have comprehensive health care.
Can Democrats in the Senate stop this legislation through the filibuster?
You know, I've heard that there are many senators who are willing to do that. The question will be if there are enough Republicans on the other side willing to take that stand as well. I have heard that the non-exemption for rape and incest is definitely concerning to folks on both sides of the aisle. So it'll be interesting to see what they do.
You know, just a final point, Republicans have also been pushing bills to undo some of the basic components of the Clean Missouri Ethics Package that voters approved last November. They are opposing efforts to make state government more transparent and stop Clean Missouri's the new way it came up with to draw legislative districts in an attempt to stop gerrymandering. How likely is it that the Republicans will succeed in altering either of those provisions?
Well, it seems pretty likely that different pieces of that will get through. You know, when it comes to the transparency or the sunshine provisions of clean, the Missouri House set forth in our rules the very first debate that we had of session that legislators did not have to turn over all of their emails and correspondence. So that was kind of step one. We've already seen a bill move through the House, which was House Bill 445, that had an amendment that not only undoes the transparency provision for the legislators, but does it for all elected officials from the governor all the way down to school boards, so that elected officials wouldn't have to turn over anything. Folks have said that this is the biggest gutting of the Sunshine Law since its inception, which was in the 70s. So that piece, you know, it made it through the House. The rules are set, you know, so that's something that doesn't have to get signed. That's something that we do within our own chamber. I'm not sure how quickly it will move through the Senate, but it seems to be that the Republicans are very proud of that piece of it. When it comes to the redistricting, you know, we've seen a few things here or there, but that's really not moving that quickly. So we're just patiently waiting to see what their priorities are.
I'm just curious what your take is. Why are Republicans so determined to change what the voters just approved?
That is a very good question, because we're not only seeing it on Clean Missouri, we're seeing it on the minimum wage increase.
Right.
We, you know, there have been multiple versions of right to work refiled from county by county. That one's in the Senate, which I don't even think could happen if it was to pass. It doesn't logistically make sense. But yeah, it's an overwhelming trend in the legislature this year to not care what the voters said. I've heard phrases like they were confused, that the voters didn't understand it, they don't know what they're voting on. I, for one, find that insulting. I believe that Missourians are definitely smart enough. They're as smart as we are as the legislature to know what they're voting on. And if they were smart enough to send our legislators back, then surely they were smart enough to know what they were voting on as well, which is kind of contradictory that folks are saying that. I find that amusing. It's frustrating that so very quickly, you know, we haven't even gone one legislative session and they're trying to undo everything that was done.
That's Missouri State Representative Crystal Quaid. She's the House Minority Leader, the leader of Democrats in the State House of Representatives in Jeff City. Representative, thanks so much for giving us a good update here. I sure appreciate
it. Of course. Thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it.
You bet. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about getting paid to act sick. It's a real job in the Kansas City area, and we're going to talk about it. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, Congressman Emanuel Cleaver and his take on the president's budget proposal and his concerns about funding for the border wall. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, the most hallowed landmark at Arlington National Cemetery. We'll talk with a former sentinel and commander at the Tomb of the Unknowns. Join us tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, today in jobs you didn't know existed, how about real people who portray patients or family members in hospitals? That's right, people who pretend they're sick or infirm to give medical students practice in something akin to a real-world experience. People actually pay to act sick. It's happening right now in Kansas City at UMKC and other medical institutions. They even have a name for them, standardized patients, or SPs, who work as living simulators. Now let's learn a little more about what standardized patients do and why their work is so important. With us, Courtney McCain is the coordinator for the standardized patient program at the UMKC School of Medicine. Courtney, good morning. Nice to have you.
Good morning, Steve. Thank you for having us this morning.
Diane Bullen is a standardized patient actor who gets paid for acting like she's sick. Diane, welcome.
Good morning, Steve.
Is it really as good as it sounds, Diane?
It's every bit as glamorous as you could imagine.
Can you act sick better than I can? Are you skilled at this?
I don't know, Steve. Yeah. I'll try.
You can do it, eh?
Yeah,
good for you. Courtney, standardized patient actors, who knew about a job like this? Where did this come from?
This really developed out of a need for students to receive the same presentation that all their other counterparts received. It's important for all students to receive the same level of training. And in clinics, it's challenging for everybody to see the same patients. So about 50 years ago, various practitioners developed a use for people to come in from the community to portray patients in various scenarios and simulations.
Like what kinds of scenarios? What are you talking about?
Any various presentation that might walk into the clinic. For instance, I'm having abdominal pain.
I'm short
of
breath.
Or I have a headache. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And each of those specific cases fulfills an objective so that the students all receive the same level of presentation and they have the same opportunity to learn and to be assessed with that.
Now, Diane has won, what, an Oscar in the course of doing all this acting as she's
as
sick?
As far as I'm concerned.
How does she rank among your actors? Is she your Oscar winner here?
Yeah. You know, we have about 65 standardized patients, and they fulfill various...
65?
65 at this point, yes. And they fulfill different objectives. We have multiple different demographics from age 18 and up. And each case fulfills a different objective that's expected of the students to master.
Diane, how did you get this gig? How did that happen?
I started with UMKC about 15 years ago.
No kidding. So you're a veteran doing this
Absolutely. I've been sick for quite some time. one of the coordinators actually saw me in an acting showcase at UMKC and said, hey, we need actors to portray patients.
Why were you interested in doing it?
I liked the challenge of it. I liked having an audience of one. Essentially, you're performing for the med student. And I found that it's really fulfilling to help be a part of improving the performance of future healthcare professionals.
How challenging is it? How tough a job is it?
After doing it for a while, I get into a routine of being able to memorize a lot of information in a short amount of time. You know, a few hours of training to learn the ins and outs, all the particular details of each case. So
you have to memorize a script in a sense, or a certain set of parameters of what you're offering the student in training here.
Yeah,
right?
And that's what makes it standardized, is that any number of actors within a certain demographic can portray the same role and be able to give the same standardized answer for the med students.
So, okay, give me an example of something you might do. Do you take it all the way from the waiting room? Do they come out and pick you up in the waiting room? How does it work?
Most encounters start within the clinic setting, so you're already waiting for
you're in the room.
For the doctor or nurse or whomever to come in. And what standardizes generally why you come in here, that's usually the first question they'll ask you. And I can say anything from, well, my leg's been bothering me, to I can't get rid of this headache, to I have abdominal pain. And then the details of each particular case go on from there.
And again, you have to follow a script of some mm-hmm. kind to sort of get through that then.
So that during the interview, the student will ask about my past medical history or my family history or my social history. And I will give them the same answer each time.
Does the doctor know you're acting?
Oh, yes.
They know you're there.
They know it's a simulation, and they know it's to help them become better communicators.
Do they ever break? Do you ever break your part and sort of just wink at them and say, hey, I mean?
Sometimes I've had some students try to make me break character, but I think we're well-trained enough where that doesn't happen.
Why do they do that? Just to have fun with you?
Probably.
Just to mess around a little
yes.
bit? Yeah. Can anybody do this, Courtney?
You know, it's not easy, and it's not for everyone.
Yeah.
And we are looking for people who are versatile. They're well spoken. There are people who are flexible with the different things that tend to happen during scenarios,
mm-hmm.
and there does need to be a very strong improvisational component to this. And so, even though we give standardized patients during training what we call it a script, but these actually are training notes. And the only real quote that we have them memorize is their opening statement. So when the student walks in and asks what brought you to the clinic today, they can give that statement, and then the student takes it from there. It's impossible really to predict what each student is going to do, what they're going to say. Some of them are very nervous, and so we try to take that into account. We give In addition to giving each standardized patient a name, a chief complaint, and how that's impacted their life or livelihood, we also give them, we try to build that character up as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So we give them a social history. We give them a background. We give them pretty much a psychological background so that they would understand how to behave, how to act. If they're supposed to act very frustrated because they're portraying somebody who's been in the waiting room for 2 hours and mm-hmm. now they're frustrated in addition to not feeling well.
That's part of the gig,
That's
too.
That's part of the gig, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And it needs to be consistent. But we also understand that the students are going to come in and they're going to approach it differently. Some of the students are going to what we call go down a rabbit hole of differential diagnosis. They may
latch onto something too quickly, you're
exactly,
saying.
Exactly, exactly. It's up to the students to ask the questions, and the standardized patients are trained not to give them any information that they didn't ask for. So it becomes very formative for the students, even though they are being, in many cases, they're being graded.
I was going to say, is there someone looking over their shoulder in the supposed little room where all this is taking place?
We do record scenarios for the students to watch later, so that they can learn from a third person perspective how they came across. But more importantly, we also allow faculty to watch these scenarios, and the standardized patients do grade from the patient perspective, so that the students understand how they came across, and faculty also understands both the positive and the challenging aspects of how that student did.
So the doctor, in a sense, the doctor in training here is a little bit like a detective. He or she is trying to sort of has to reach a certain conclusion by the end of the exercise, right? That's the objective here. They've got to solve the crime, if you will, in a certain way.
If that is where they are in their training. We start them out with very easy scenarios. UMKC is a school that it's a six-year program, and so it's accelerated. Our students begin the medical school portion in their third year, and we start them in scenarios within the first 2 weeks of their first year in medical school, as it were.
Wow.
So even before they have learned examination techniques, we work with them with their communication. We start with that element.
You want
it.
This to become part of who they are as budding doctors, then it sounds like.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a strong communication element. We start that early. And then we build different elements into that. If they've just learned about, for instance, the neurological system, then we build a case that will meet those objectives. And then the next time they see standardized patients, they might see a standardized patient with a headache or with arm weakness or with, you know, name the various hundreds of situations that they may have learned about that may occur as part of that, what we call that system.
Yeah. How nervous are some of them, Diane, when they come in to see you?
Sometimes they can be pretty nervous, but for the most part, I think they're trained in knowing how to ask the right questions.
Mm-hmm.
So they themselves have a little bit of a script, or they learn mnemonic devices so that they don't forget to ask.
Like what kinds of questions are you talking about?
Everything from past medical history. Are you taking any medications right now? Family history. Are there any diagnoses that run in your family? Can sometimes be important to solving the mystery of, like you say, being a detective, a good curious detective. Social history. Asking whether you smoke can often play a factor. So it's finding out those little details that are really important in getting an accurate diagnosis.
Are you ever tempted to sort of help them out, the ones who are struggling, and say, hey, why don't you ask me about this?
Wish we could, but we would not be doing them service, you know, if we fed them the answers. They you know, that's part of the training, you know, in their medical school program.
What's the most common mistake they make?
Oh, gosh. Probably overlooking or skipping a lot of that backstory that's provided.
They're
in our
nervous
training
and
notes.
They're in a hurry to get somewhere.
Yes. Or they, like Courtney said, go down a rabbit hole and they're pretty sure it's one thing and then they skip a lot of details that could have provided a lot more information that's pertinent to the case.
You can't help but sort of smile at the whole thing. You can't smile, right? You got to be serious.
Of course. But in the back of my mind, I know that we're better that they make mistakes on diagnosing me than somebody who's actually ill.
Do they get involved in physically examining you? Or
sometimes.
Is it just a rhetorical thing?
Yeah. No, sometimes there is a physical exam involved.
Yeah.
And also in addition to memorizing all the details of the case, we also have to observe, well, did they listen to my heart and lungs properly? Did they do a correct abdominal exam? So we have to note that. And so when we provide feedback for them, we can say whether or not those things occurred.
Hey, so do you actually fill out a report once every session has concluded?
Most times with encounters, we do fill out feedback, and sometimes there are opportunities to provide verbal feedback to the students.
Right when it's over?
Yes.
Do you grade them?
No, I don't.
You don't do that.
I can only provide the feedback, but that's up to the faculty.
Yeah. You know, I can't help but wonder, Courtney, you pay the actors to do this?
We do.
Yeah. Can I ask how much? Can I do it? can this become a sidelight for me?
Standardized patients make $20 an hour.
Oh, that's pretty good.
They are irregular part-time employees with the university. This is not a regular gig. There are no guaranteed hours. Casting is done primarily on projected case requests from faculty.
And you actually call it casting.
We call it casting.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
It's much like casting a play.
Mm-hmm.
It does have to be very specific. For an example, if I'm trying to cast a case that was sent to me by faculty involving a 20-year-old female college student who is having lower abdominal pain and she's afraid she might be pregnant, Obviously, I cannot cast that with a 60-year-old male.
You think?
I recognize that many actors have fantastic range.
You're a very good doctor, Courtney.
That would not be feasible, nor would it be accurate.
Yeah. If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about, an acting gig at the UMKC School of Medicine, where folks come in and sort of portray patients to help train doctors. If you have questions for our good guests here, 816-235-2888 is our phone number, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. You know, you guys have something, Courtney, called a communication assessment rubric. What is that, and why is it so important?
Well, the communication assessment rubric basically delineates through a scale communication and professionalism. Those are elements that are very important for student physicians and student clinicians in general to develop so that there's a good therapeutic relationship with their patients.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it's very difficult to measure. And so through various evidence-based principles, we've been able to develop a checklist that delineates on a scale from acceptable to outstanding, from unacceptable to outstanding, each of those elements. And one category, just to give you an example, is empathy.
Mm-hmm.
And students who are responsive and sensitive to a patient's needs will score higher on the scale than students who don't acknowledge how an illness or a challenging situation would impact that patient.
You know, there are a lot of people listening to this right now who are thinking, the doctor I go to right now could use a refresher course, because
we hear that a lot.
When it comes to bedside manners and doctors, a lot of doctors are flunking every day because they're busy, right? The pressures on them these days to whirl through a lot of patients is pretty dramatic. So you do hear that a lot, it sounds like.
We do hear that a lot. But as with any role, all of our standardized patients need to set aside any of their personal biases and personal experiences with their own physicians and remain true to the character and the case they're portraying.
Mm-hmm.
And as with any evaluator, they need to evaluate fairly the student that they are seeing, using the objective checklists that are provided by our faculty.
I'm just wondering, Diane, if you go to your own doctor sometimes and you want to sort of pull him, he or she, by the necktie and say, hey, come on, get your act together, because you're flagging on any number of these metrics at UMKC.
Oh, I let them know what I do for a living, jobs. Yeah. And it's always fun to joke with them. You know, I can talk about, oh, well, that was really good compassion that you showed for me. That's really good empathy and humanism skills you displayed right there. So good job.
Do you ever say to them, no, you failed on any number of metrics here?
No, fortunately I have not. But no, it's good to know. That's the most fulfilling, important thing that I think is part of my job, is that I hope that future healthcare professionals will go on to be better verbal communicators and be able to show the empathy and humanism that we train them to express.
Are doctors required to get refresher courses like sort of lawyers are occasionally, stay up with current practices and standards? And would bedside manner be a mandatory thing that you would recommend, Courtney?
Well, all healthcare providers are required to retain their certifications and licenses. They're required to receive continuing education.
Yeah.
But depending on the practice, sometimes it's separated into different categories. I do wish that there could be more of an emphasis on bedside manner and professionalism, because we all recognize how important it is. If a patient feels dismissed, or if a patient feels condescended to,
you got a problem.
Yeah, and they're not going to want to come back for healthcare. And that's especially devastating if somebody has a condition that they need help with and they don't seek care because they've been mistreated in the past. And so,
Diane,
that's part of why we do this.
I got 10 seconds. What's the toughest malady to portray?
Things that are outside the diagnosis, whether it's domestic violence, or I had to play Breaking Bad News, somebody telling me that, you know, I have a terminal illness, or, you know, or even just a cultural sensitivity training. That's also very important and also difficult to portray.
That's Diane Bullen. She's a standardized patient actor who gets paid for acting like she's sick over at UMKC. Courtney McCain also joined us. She's the coordinator for the standardized patient program at the UMKC School of Medicine. Thank you both. very much. Sure enjoyed it.
Yeah,
appreciate
thank you.
It.
Thank
yeah.
you for having us.
Tomorrow on the show, your body has an elegant defense. The amazing things we've learned about the human immune system, that'll be on tomorrow's show. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.